You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says farms across the country have become hotspots for the coronavirus. We'll look at how that happened and what's being done about it. First, the international community is taking action against Belarus following its crackdown on protesters since its August 9th election. Longtime President Alexander Lukashenko was declared the winner. Opposition parties, the U.S. and the European Union, all say the election was fixed. That set off mass protests in the capital city of Minsk. Thousands have been arrested. There's also been widespread evidence of abuse and torture. At least four people have reportedly died in the demonstrations. Just yesterday, the European Union imposed sanctions on 40 Belarusian officials, not Lukashenko. Earlier this month, the U.S. State Department announced it no longer recognizes him as the legitimate president. What does all this mean for the relationship between America and Belarus, and how might our election next month change our approach in the region? David Schultz is a professor of political science at law at Hamline University and a professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's also taught, lectured, and spoken in Eastern Europe and will lead a panel discussion on the events in Belarus on Monday. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
David, President Lukashenko has been in charge of this country since 1994. Talk about the origins of his rule in this post-Soviet state.
Well, let's think about where it's located first off. Belarus is located between Poland, Russia, Ukraine, and Lithuania. And you're correct. It was part of the Soviet Union for many years. And when the Soviet Union broke up in 1991, Belarus became independent. And Lukashenko was elected in 1994. And at the time that he was elected, he decided to sort of keep on the path of where the Soviet Union used to be, kept the industries nationalized, kept sort of a path in the direction that looked very much like what the Soviet Union used to look like. And after that one free election in 1994, there's been questions regarding about the fairness and integrity of the rest of the elections. In the last few years, the economy of Belarus has slowed down. The population has become much more highly educated, and there's been demands for change within the country. The elections that happened back in August are highly contested by the population with Belarus, with many people claiming that they were rigged. And in the last few weeks, there's been significant just demonstrations of what, over 100,000 people every weekend, with the government responding by arresting many of those demonstrators. So that kind of sets the context in terms of what's happening there.
And what's been the American position toward Belarus over the years?
Over the years, I think the United States has taken a position that for the most part, you know, Belarus, which used to be part of the Soviet Union, was kind of more within the, let's say, the Russian Federation's like zone of influence. Russia is very concerned about making sure that Belarus stays under the Russian zone, kind of a buffer between it and the European Union and, more importantly, in NATO. But in the last couple of years, as Lukashenko has aged, and some people describe him, quote here, as the last dictator of Europe, as he's sort of aging, the United States has started to view potentially that Belarus could be maybe possibly moved more towards the West, much in the same way that we're seeing similar efforts to try to move Ukraine or Georgia, also as countries towards the West. And so it's been below the radar screen for most Americans. Most United States citizens don't hear much about that country or efforts, but certainly within, let us say, the diplomatic circles, it has been a increasing country of importance. And I know when I've gone over to lecture over in Belarus, there has been interest in terms of me being able to talk to people over there in terms of discussing American politics and American policy to educate the students over there.
What has been the American response so far to this country, as you say, that hasn't been a household word for most Americans since the election, since the protests?
I think at first it was somewhat quiet. We know Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, has increasingly tried to ratchet up a little bit some of the rhetoric, is trying to impose or lead some sanctions. But still, it's a delicate balance that's here, because one of the concerns that the citizens of Belarus have, they don't want it to look like the United States or NATO or that the European Union is trying to pull Belarus over into the Western European orbit for fear, perhaps, that it might trigger some international events. What's really going on in Belarus is that this is not a anti-Russian movement. It is not necessarily a pro-Western movement. It's more what? It's a democracy movement. You know, many of us might have heard a few years ago the different color revolutions, you know, like the Velvet Revolution, the Orange Revolutions, and Purple Revolutions in different countries over in Eastern Europe. Think of this also as a indigenous democratic movement, of which the United States, again, is trying to walk a delicate path. It would like to see democracy in Belarus, but it's certainly not going to take actions, I think, at this point, that are going to trigger, let us say, an adverse reaction from other people and other countries across the world.
And what are you watching for next in the country?
What I'm watching for next at this point are the demonstrations going to continue. At what point, I think the really critical issue becomes, so far that Lukashenko has been able to keep control of the military and support him. And I'm going to draw an analogy. Back when the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, you know, in Eastern Europe or in Germany, what happened at some point is when the guards no longer supported the regime, that's really what brought down the East German regime. And that's what I'm looking for to see here. At what point, if at all, does the military, does the KGB, and they still call it the KGB in Belarus, do they continue to support Lukashenko? Or at what point do they get overwhelmed by the demonstrators? Do they get overwhelmed by the democracy movement? And at that point, if that were to happen, that will be a critical tipping point in terms of what's happening in that country.
Talking to David Schultz from Hamline University. Want to switch gears for our last few minutes and look a little closer to home. I know you and I think everybody is watching this news from the White House, the president and the first lady, among others, having positive COVID-19 test results. What is your reaction to that news?
Well, my reaction is in thinking in terms of sort of two things down the line. Remember, I'm a law professor also. So I've been telling people that I won't get into the politics of whether or not, you know, about what he has done in terms of his advocacy or his opposition to what mask wearing and the virus, but instead to think about questions about what happens if he's incapacitated in terms of presidential succession or in terms of Mike Pence having to step in temporarily. And with that, let's say it goes in a different direction. I'm thinking about what if, for example, Donald Trump has to withdraw from the presidential race in terms of what that means. And so that's where my focus is turning now. And I've been sort of doing a little bit of writing about that today, sketching out what the Constitution says, what the Republican National Committee rules say. And the simple answer is that the presidential succession or taking care of the problems that an ill or incapacitated President Trump may face are easy by comparison to what to do with an incapacitated candidate, Donald Trump. And so we're looking at two different sets of issues here.
What happens, just speaking more generically now, if a presidential candidate, you know, they've been through the nomination and for whatever reason, they're no longer able to continue the race, what is the procedure for coming up with a new candidate after ballots are already printed?
Well, Republican National Committee Rule 9 allows them to pick whomever they want to replace, let's say in this case, Donald Trump. It doesn't have to be Mike Pence, but it could be. That's the easy part. The harder part now is, I don't know how many tens of millions of ballots have already been cast at this point. We have, with what, 31 days to go, the ballots are already printed up. What happens in terms of replacing Donald Trump on the ballot across the 50 different states is a legal question for each of the 50 states. But even beyond the legal question, there's a practicality and a technical question of how would you actually be able to replace his name, get somebody else on the ballot, and actually print the ballots or have them available for election day, let alone now go back and take care of all those absentee ballots. So these are going to be the issues that I want to say we all hope don't have to occur, and we all wish him well, but we have to be thinking about these practicalities.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
David Schultz is a professor of political science and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. We talked to him mostly about the events in Belarus and how America is reacting to the situation in Eastern Europe. By the way, we'll get the latest on President Trump's positive test for COVID-19 coming up at about 4:35. Coming up next, we'll look at how farms in the U.S. became hot zones for COVID-19. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Senate Republicans are hoping to confirm a new Supreme Court justice by the end of the month, but cases of COVID-19 are casting some doubt on that timeline. We'll look at the process ahead and what a bigger conservative majority could mean for the country. First, according to the Washington Post, some American farms have become hotbeds for the coronavirus. During harvest season, growers for some of the country's largest agricultural companies failed to test workers for COVID-19. In addition, advocates say there was no mandatory personal protective equipment or clear guidance on worker safety. Those failures may have put millions of workers at greater risk of contracting COVID and spreading it to others as they move to farms across state lines. Microsoft and Purdue University say that as of last week, around 128,000 farm workers have tested positive for the virus. That doesn't include part-time or temporary workers. By comparison, that figure is three times higher than the reported number of meatpacking workers who have tested positive. Laura Riley is the Business of Food reporter at The Washington Post. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me today.
Is this something that's isolated, Laura, to a few farms in a few states, or is this something we're seeing going on around the country?
Well, I got access to thousands of pages of public records across 10 different states. So this is a widespread problem and will continue to be so, largely because many of these workers are migratory. You know, they work 6 weeks here and 8 weeks somewhere else. And often by the time a municipality or a state has decided, oh, we've got a problem here, those workers have moved on somewhere else. So that's kind of the major problem with this group of workers.
Let's talk about that workforce a little bit before we dig more into COVID-19. This is an invisible, I think to a lot of people, an invisible part of our food system, these migrant workers, many of them coming from Mexico or Central America. Can you tell us about this workforce?
Sure. So we have about 3 million farm workers total that have all been deemed essential workers in the pandemic. We have roughly 220,000 that are H-2A visa holders, largely from Mexico. So these are legal visa holders who come through with basically a contractor who sets them up for the season. But we have another 1.5 million undocumented workers. And I think a lot of the major problems have been with that group because they frequently have fears of deportation or losing work. They don't have anywhere to self-isolate. They have language barriers. They have fears of big hospital bills. So they may be a little more reluctant to get tested or to be documented or, you know, contact traced through this process.
And when I think of this kind of work, I think, well, they're outside, they're spread out. Maybe there's not such proximity that leads to spread, except what I'm not thinking about is where they sleep and where they eat. Can you talk about the conditions that they work and live in that actually might make them very high risk, in fact?
Absolutely. So they are frequently in congregate housing. So often a grower or the contractor who's brought them in from Mexico or Latin America, they set them up in housing. And one piece that didn't end up in the final story, but was very troubling to me, is that New Jersey has this long history of bringing in Haitian workers to do the blueberries for about 8 weeks every summer. And they're put up in pole barns with no indoor plumbing, in bunk beds, basically. And what the state of New Jersey said for them to do to kind of protect the workers is, oh, just put up some shower curtains between these bunk beds. So clearly not sufficient, given what we know now about kind of aerosolated, you know, particles. So a lot of these workers live together. They get up in the morning. Most of them don't have transportation of their own. So they get picked up in the morning, you know, 5 a.m., 6 a.m. in school buses, kind of packed in. So there's, or even worst case scenarios, they're picked up in the back of a roll down back U-Haul. So no ability to socially distance or isolate. Lots of opportunity for spread. They often are cooking together at the end of the day. They often have, no running water in the field. So there's no way to wash their hands if they've gone to the bathroom, et cetera. And then if you think about where people are in the field, yes, they are distant one from another as they're doing their work, but where do they take their breaks? You know, it's under the only shade tree. And on Friday, when they're going to get their paycheck, they're clustered around the back of the pickup truck where the grower is doling out the checks. So there are all these places built into their workday where congregating closely is unavoidable.
Talking to Laura Riley, reporter at the Washington Post, about her work on COVID-19 and farm workers, migratory farm workers in the United States at high risk, lots of positive cases. Laura, you spent a lot of time in this piece looking at what companies did and didn't do in response. What did you see as this disease was spreading around the country?
Well, I'm not going to put it all on growers. States were really, behind on this. So we had 11 states that eventually came around to having mandatory PPE, 20 states that have non-enforceable guidelines, and many states that say nothing about what is required of growers to give their workers or to demand of their workers in terms of PPE or social distancing. Growers frequently, in many of the states that I looked at, discouraged testing, strongly discouraged, and in fact, threaten deportation or, losing jobs to workers that came forward testing positive or demanded testing. So, there was very little contact tracing. I talked to lots of kind of state legislators and health affairs workers that said a lot of times when a worker tests positive, they kind of disappear. They give a wrong phone number. They don't, they don't respond. They kind of, disappear in the shuffle here. So it's even when growers have had every good intention of tracking outbreaks, there are ways in which the system makes that very, very difficult.
You report on at least one instance where a grower angrily and actively resisted the health department bringing in testing and trying to talk to workers, right?
Well, I saw that again and again with growers who said, my workers don't want to be tested. Or you'd have these organizations, Doctors Without Borders, et cetera, that would come into a community and set up testing. Obviously, you can't really set up testing for farm workers far away from where they are because they don't have wheels of their own. And it can't be during the workday. They're not going to take time off of work. So it has to be in the evening, on the weekend, but also not so far away from where they live that they can't get there. But even when all of those challenges were met, a lot of times growers strongly discouraged workers from being tested. And then once workers did test positive in a lot of cases, there was nowhere for them to self-isolate. They would be put up four to a hotel room or a motel room, four men with no family relationship, just strangers to each other put up in a hotel room. And if you are test positive, what are you supposed to do in that circumstance?
Have we seen states start to take action to require protections for these workers?
Absolutely. So states like California, a huge ag state, one of the biggest, they have demanded PPE. And then, you have the wildfires that have caused the PPE that was originally surgical masks to pivot to N95s to get rid of that particulate matter from the fire. So they've had numerous challenges there in kind of the Central Valley and some of the other areas that are, the grape growing in Northern California. But yes, I mean, states are pivoting, but some of the early ones, Florida has a really early growing season. I mean, they call it kind of the spring salad bowl of the United States. So they start harvesting March, April, May. And they really didn't get their act together to start testing until June, once most of the workers had moved on. So it really was kind of a rolling, problem.
You mentioned that workers might be reluctant to speak out about these things for fear of being fired or deported. You did hear from some workers who did try to raise concerns. What kind of things did they experience?
I talked to a number of workers, and almost invariably it was, off the record or name changes or that kind of thing, because they were all incredibly afraid of losing their jobs. A lot of these people are low income. I mean, average farm worker earns, $22,000, $24,000 a year. Incredibly, it's a low income job. And a lot of them are sending money back to, Mexico or elsewhere in Latin America or South America. So they're very afraid of losing work, and a lot of them don't have health insurance. I mean, I talked to one worker who went in to get a COVID test and was diagnosed with a hernia and ended up with a, you know, $30,000 hospital bill that there was no way he was going to pay. So there are a lot of impediments to tracking this effectively.
Where in the country are you watching right now to see how workers are doing and how companies or states might be changing protections?
Well, you gotta follow the harvest. So a lot of the southern states now, or the southern part of the country, are done with whatever they grow. So workers are moving. We're moving into the northern Midwest. You know, there's still harvest going on in Washington and Oregon. So those are the places that are still likely to be hotspots for a while. But I think that the problem has been, you know, unlike meatpacking or processing workers, you know, those workers live in your community. You know, their kids play Little League with your kids. They you know, pay taxes, they, et cetera. You know, they're part of the fabric of your community. And so it's much more, the onus is on local communities to track that much more effectively than these workers who flit in and out, you know, for 4 weeks at a time every year. So I think that this is going to be an ongoing problem until we have you know, a vaccine or some kind of effective cure.
Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks.
Laura Riley is the Business of Food reporter at The Washington Post. We talked to her today about COVID-19 outbreaks at U.S. farms over the course of the harvest seasons around the country. The Post reported that growers in many states largely failed to test migrant workers or provide them with personal protective equipment. 11 states, including Wisconsin, have introduced some mandatory protections for farm workers over the course of the pandemic. Coming up, we'll look at the judicial record of Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett and talk about what to expect from the confirmation process getting underway this month. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7 on The Morning Show, Wisconsin has been seeing some big numbers when it comes to COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations. The state's top medical official joins the show with a look at the latest numbers and the effort to turn things around. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, President Trump is said to be experiencing mild symptoms of COVID-19. Just before midnight, he tweeted that he and First Lady Melania Trump had tested positive for the coronavirus and will begin quarantining immediately. In addition, senior White House aide Hope Hicks, RNC Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, and Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah have also tested positive over the last couple of days. Now, the White House announcing that the president, out of an abundance of caution, they say, as a precaution, is going to be headed to Walter Reed Hospital for monitoring. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent with The Hill and the author of Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. He's a regular guest on our Week in Washington segment, including this past Wednesday. Reed, welcome back.
Hey, Rob, how are you?
Good. Well, this story changing quickly through the day. What is the latest word that you're hearing and watching for?
Well, we know that President Trump is on his way to Walter Reed, which is the hospital in Northwest Washington that takes care of the president and of course, military families who are stationed in the area. This is a pretty big deal. Going to Walter Reed is not something that a president does frequently. Remember that President Trump went unannounced once last year for a medical issue that the White House said was a routine checkup, but we don't really know what actually happened there. This is serious, and it's a reminder, I think, that if even the person in perhaps the most protective bubble in the world can get the coronavirus, then any of us can. And so we need to redouble our efforts to wear the mask, to wash the hands, to stay away from everybody as much as possible, because this is a really serious virus. And President Trump is in a prime age and health category to suffer some bad consequences from this. I mean, we know that this virus affects men more than women. It affects older people more than younger people. And it affects people with comorbidities, which include being overweight. And that is not a good thing. Now, the overwhelming odds are that the president will be fine and will recover. But this is still a moment to be very concerned about his health.
And we'll be watching that. I know there's a lot of speculation out there, and I don't want to go too far in that direction. But another part of the story is the president was in contact with a lot of people. I listed some of the names who have also had positive tests: Republican Senator Mike Lee, White House aide Hope Hicks, the RNC chairwoman Ronna McDaniel. A lot of these people at similar events on Air Force One, events marking the nomination of a new Supreme Court nominee. What are people watching there for who else might get this now?
Well, we know that a very small number of people who get the coronavirus are responsible for a very substantial majority of the spread. We don't know why, but that's the emerging consensus out of big studies that have come out of places like India. So what we're looking for is, where did all of these people who were in a very a few number of events together contract this virus? Now, it appears that Ronna McDaniel, the RNC chairwoman, was last with President Trump at a fundraiser on Friday. As you mentioned, a lot of these people were at the introduction of Judge Amy Comey Barrett at the White House on Saturday. So one of these events appears to have been a super spreader event in which a lot of people got sick. Now, let's hope that nobody else tests positive. But we know that, you know, for example, Vice President Mike Pence has tested negative. Now, just testing negative doesn't mean you don't have the virus. You can still develop it later. But hopefully he has avoided it, despite the fact that he was sitting one row in front of Mike Lee at that Supreme Court introduction on Saturday.
And now we have this incredible high-level contact tracing. White House staff, Minnesota Republican officials who were at a President Trump's event very recently, people at a fundraiser in New Jersey, I think, with President Trump, U.S. senators, former Vice President Joe Biden shared a stage. They were both maskless, not that far apart. The vice president has also had a negative test. People are now rushing, I imagine, Reed, to find out who is in contact with the president and these other officials who have tested positive.
Yeah, and it's made all the more complicated by the number of different places he's been in the last couple of weeks. New Jersey yesterday for a rally in Minnesota. So there are going to be a lot of states now who are trying to track down everybody who's been anywhere near proximity with President Trump. And that's not just going to include people like Joe Biden and Mike Pence and White House staffers. It's showed up at Bedminster, the golf course in New Jersey, for the fundraiser last week.
I think we're losing our connection with Reed Wilson. We'll leave it there. Thanks to Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill and author of the book Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. We talked to him about President Trump testing positive for COVID-19. Stay tuned to NPR News at each hour and half hour, and follow the latest at NPR.org. Now, the Senate Judiciary Committee says it's still on track to start confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett on October 12th. Coney Barrett has been on President Trump's list of potential nominees for a couple years now, and he hopes to have her confirmed by the November 3rd election. Cases of COVID-19 in Washington are putting that in some doubt. A potential 6-3 conservative majority on the court could quickly leave its mark on issues like health care, immigration, abortion, and more. Amy Howe is the co-founder of SCOTUS Blog. She still reports on the Supreme Court for the blog and writes at amylhowe.com. Amy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's great to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Well, all reporting this year seems to turn into COVID-19 reporting. First of all, Amy, is this shaking up the confirmation process? At least one U.S. senator now testing positive.
It's not entirely clear yet. You know, Lindsey Graham tweeted, he's the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee right now, tweeted shortly before noon that he looked forward to welcoming Senator Lee, who has tested positive for COVID-19 as a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, back to the committee to start hearings for Amy Coney Barrett on October the 12th. I know that Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's one of the senior Democrats on the committee, and Senator Chuck Schumer had expressed concern about going forward with the hearings. You know, certainly Senator Feinstein's 87, Senator Chuck Grassley, who's on the committee, is 87. Senator Patrick Leahy, who's another senior Democrat on the committee, is 80. But Senator Graham wants to move forward with the 3 days of hearings starting on October 12th. It's not really clear, whether or not Democrats, there's anything they can do to stop it. You know, I think there is some precedent for having, confirmation hearings, if not of Supreme Court justices, certainly, but of lower court judges virtually. So that, perhaps that's an option.
Well, you've written a profile of Judge Amy Coney Barrett, actually before we knew she was the nominee. What stands out to you about her as a nominee and potential Supreme Court justice?
Well, one thing it's a little bit ironic is that, she was high on the president's list in no small part because of her 2017 confirmation hearings. She was a law professor for about 15 years. And then was nominated by the president in 2017 to take a seat on the federal appeals court that sits in Chicago. And Senator Feinstein and some of the other Democratic senators questioned the extent to which her Catholic beliefs, her Catholic faith might influence her judging. And Senator Feinstein, in this moment that's gone viral, said, the dogma lives loudly within you. And that really made her actually, I think, a hero among religious conservatives. The coffee mugs and T-shirts were made. She was confirmed at the end of October 2017. And a couple of weeks later, when the president released a new list of potential Supreme Court nominees, there was Judge Amy Coney Barrett on the list.
There are two things I think people look at. Partly it's the resume and qualifications. Partly it's ideology, legal philosophy, that kind of thing. On the resume side of things, how does Judge Coney Barrett stack up?
She has not been on the Court of Appeals quite as long as the president's two prior nominees, Justice Neil Gorsuch and Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Justice Gorsuch was on the Court of Appeals for 11 years, and Justice Gorsuch was on the Court of Appeals for 12 years. But 3 years is, I think, certainly... I don't think anyone is going to question that that's long enough on the Court of Appeals. Justice Elena Kagan did not sit on the Court of Appeals at all. And I think that there's not a lot of dispute about whether or not, she sort of has the intellectual firepower to do the job. I think the dispute is really going to be much more about ideology.
Talking to Amy Howe, co-founder of SCOTUS blog and a regular reporter on the Supreme Court, about nominee Amy Coney Barrett and the confirmation hearings ahead. We'll get into some of those issues of important cases on the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the confirmation process for this Supreme Court seat should move forward or wait until after the election or after the inauguration? What do you think of this particular nominee, Amy Coney Barrett? Is there an issue you are hopeful for or worried about should she end up on the court? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Amy Howe, Supreme Court reporter and co-founder of SCOTUS blog, looking at nominee Judge Amy Coney Barrett and the impact she could have on the court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on whether the confirmation process should go forward now before the election, now in the midst of concerns about COVID-19 among U.S. senators and White House staff, including the president, and questions and concerns about what another justice, a conservative-leaning justice, could mean for big issues? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Amy, let's talk about the ideological side of things. What do we know based on Judge Coney Barrett's record about what she might look like as a Supreme Court justice?
Probably the most telling thing was what she said at her remarks in the Rose Garden on Saturday. She talked about the late Justice Antonin Scalia, for whom she served as a law clerk, and she said, "His judicial philosophy is mine." Justice Scalia was what's known as an originalist, which means that he believed when you're interpreting the Constitution, you look at the words as the people who drafted them and what the people who drafted them intended them to mean. You don't interpret the words in the way, with a view to how the country might have changed over the last 200 some odd years. And then when you're interpreting a law, you look at the words on the page. It's what's known as textualism. And so if that's the case, and we have no reason to believe it wouldn't be, she said his judicial philosophy is mine, it seems like she would be one of the more conservative members of the Supreme Court, probably more like Justice Neil Gorsuch than Justice Brett Kavanaugh, to sort of put her in comparison with the president's two prior appointees.
We have a big court case coming up on the Affordable Care Act, a legal challenge to it from states backed by the Trump administration along the way. Do you see this particular justice, if she ends up being a justice, swaying that outcome one way or another?
You know, that is a great question. You know, it's a complicated case. We do know that this was a case back in 2012. It's a challenge to that. Back in 2012, the Supreme Court reviewed a challenge to the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate. It's the requirement that almost all Americans either buy health insurance or pay a penalty. And as many of your listeners probably remember, the Chief Justice, John Roberts, joined the court's former liberal justices in holding that this mandate was constitutional because it was a tax. Congress has the power to tax people. And so back in 2017, Congress essentially eliminated the tax for failing to get health insurance and said, you still have to buy health insurance, but if you don't buy health insurance, the penalty is zero. So Texas and a group of states went to court and said, well, if the mandate was constitutional because it's a tax, and now there's no tax, it can't be constitutional anymore. So that issue is back at the Supreme Court. You know, now there are eight justices right now on the Supreme Court. Justice Ginsburg, was one of the justices in the majority who said that the mandate was constitutional, has passed away. And so it's a question. There are a couple of things going on. You know, Justice Kavanaugh was not on the Supreme Court at the time. He replaced Justice Kennedy. And some things that Justice Kavanaugh wrote when he was a lower court judge at least suggest that he might have voted like the Chief Justice John Roberts. So in that case, perhaps, you know, a Justice Barrett might not make a difference. But we do know that Judge Barrett, in some of her academic writings, really questioned the Chief Justice's interpretation of the mandate. She said, really, that's not a plausible interpretation of the statute. So, you know, if it came to her, if she were the deciding vote, you know, she might vote to say that the individual mandate is unconstitutional. But then the Supreme Court has to deal with the second question, which is what happens? Is it just the individual mandate that is unconstitutional, or does the whole Affordable Care Act fall with it? And so then that's a separate question. And we're not really sure about her views on this question. It's a legal question called severability. But we do know, again, that not only the Chief Justice, but Justice Kavanaugh have both said that in most cases, the Supreme Court should not strike down the whole law. They should just leave. They should just take out the unconstitutional part.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Charles is with us in Fall Creek. Charles, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I was, just kind of disappointed that we're appointing a Supreme Court justice now when back in 2016, when President Obama tried to do it, it was absolutely no question, not going to happen. Just seems like they're really going back on their word. And I mean, based on my own values, I'm afraid that the Roe versus Wade would be overturned.
Charles, thanks for the call. Let's first start with the Merrick Garland issue here, his nomination blocked, not even hearings on that. Amy, how have you seen that turnaround in the Senate?
You know, it's been an interesting one to watch. You know, back earlier in the year before Justice Ginsburg passed away, you know, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had made clear that if there was a vacancy, he was going to fill it. And he said that the difference between 2016 is that now there is a Republican White House and a Republican Senate. I think for Democrats, you know, they think they really regard that as a distinction without a difference, that this is really incredibly unfair and hypocritical of the Republicans. But there's not a whole lot that they can do unless they could convince at least four Republicans not to vote for a nominee. And it doesn't appear that they're at least right now, that they've been able to do that.
Talking to Amy Howe, longtime Supreme Court watcher, co-founder of the SCOTUS blog. You can read her work at that blog at amylhowe.com. Charles also brought up Amy Roe versus Wade, a lot of eyes on that issue. I know states, many states have been changing laws, hoping in some cases to bring it to the U.S. Supreme Court. What are you watching for on that issue?
Yes. I mean, so the Supreme Court has heard oral argument recently and decided a couple of cases involving abortion, but did not decide direct challenges to Roe versus Wade. But as you've suggested, states have been trying to bring that issue to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court quite soon is expected to decide whether or not to take up a case out of Mississippi that involves a ban on abortions, I believe, after 15 weeks. So getting a little bit closer to Roe versus Wade. You know, I think that the Democrats have really focused on health care as an issue at these, a possible issue at these hearings. But I think it was just yesterday, although, you know, in these news cycles, it feels like a million years ago. You know, The Guardian was reporting about a two-page ad that Amy Coney Barrett had signed back in 2006, you know, calling Roe versus Wade, you know, sort of a raw exercise of judicial power. You know, it was an anti-abortion ad published by an anti-abortion group in the South Bend, Indiana area where she lives. And so, you know, I'll be fascinated to see whether or not, you know, they make more of this, in the run-up to the hearings and then at the hearings.
This also comes down to a judicial philosophy issue that might seem a little arcane, but the idea of whether justices on today's Supreme Court should flip a ruling from a previous Supreme Court unless there's some significant change from it. Do we have a sense of this nominee and how she approaches that kind of decision? And if you want to explain that better than I did, please do.
Sure. No, absolutely. There's a doctrine called stare decisis, which is the idea that normally courts should not overturn their prior decisions unless there's a very good reason to do so. And the idea is that it gives everyone a sense of predictability. And this has become very important with Roe versus Wade, because Roe versus Wade is a decision that, you know, is nearly 50 years old now. And so the Supreme Court has been kind of sparring in recent years when the Supreme Court has thought about overturning or has in fact overturned its prior precedent. And we've seen this play out in a couple of cases, including one last year involving whether or not if you are on trial for a serious crime in a state court, whether or not you have a constitutional right to have the jury verdict against you be unanimous. And the Supreme Court had to overturn its prior precedent to rule that, yes, in fact, you do have such a right. But it didn't necessarily, the votes didn't necessarily play out the way you might have expected, including that Justice Elena Kagan, who we think of as being part of the court's more liberal bloc, was in the dissent, perhaps thinking down the line of other cases in which the Supreme Court might want to overturn its precedent. And this is an issue that came up at her confirmation hearing when she was on the, going for the Court of Appeals. And it's an easy thing to address when you're on the Court of Appeals, because you are bound by the decisions of the Supreme Court. But obviously, once you're on the Supreme Court can overturn its prior precedent, and it has overturned its earlier cases. And so it's something that she has written about, and I expect that we will hear a lot more questions about it. She's written about it in kind of an academic sense, and you have the sense that she would be, like Justice Scalia, she's not someone who's necessarily going to, charge right out and overturn her prior precedent, but on the other hand, is not completely adverse to it, I guess is how I would say.
In our last 30 seconds, Amy, sometimes in normal times when we have a big confirmation battle, there's this huge campaign and ad blitzes and things like that. We're in the middle of a presidential race this time. Are we going to see as much of a national political storm over this as we might usually?
I think we will. I think that there are, it's my understanding that there are already groups that are very active, this is their field, and that they are spending money on ad campaigns. And there is, you know, we haven't had a lot of time to talk about it. There's so much at stake. That is the perception from both sides. You know, the potential, if you're a conservative, to sort of solidify a solid 6-3 majority on the Supreme Court for, you know, potentially, she's 48 years old, for decades to come. And, you know, for Democrats, the same thing. And but obviously they view that in a very different way.
Amy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
That's Amy Howe with SCOTUS Blog. She writes at amylhowe.com, looking at the latest Supreme Court news. Monday on the morning show, get the latest from behind the scenes at Wisconsin Public Radio at 8. It's this edition of Mondays with Mike. Coming up here on Central Time, it's Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.